Hampton Roads is home to the largest coal export operation in the United States. The coal is extracted from coal mines, then raced in open train cars to the coal terminals off the coast of Virginia, where it's dumped into ever-growing giant piles of coal to be loaded onto cargo ships for sale across the world. All that dumping and storing releases plumes of black, oily coal particles into the air. And legally, each coal terminal in that region is allowed to emit 150 tons of coal dust into the air every year. And every year, people inhale that coal dust.
Andy had asthma. He was a military brat, just like me and Malcolm were. I believe Andy was born in Hawaii, and he said the air was so much better there, but then when he moved to Virginia, it was really bad.
This is Lathaniel Kurtz. He grew up playing outside, not far from the coal terminals at the port in Norfolk, Virginia. And he remembers his friend Andy, who struggled to breathe when they played.
He used to be able to run all day and run on the sand and have a good time and, you know, never really get tired. But when he got here, he said he used to have asthma attacks and he used to have an inhaler.
Now, Lathaniel Kurtz and his friend and collaborator Malcolm Jones are working with the University of Virginia's Repair Lab to seek environmental justice for the decades of coal dust that they inhaled. From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell, and today we're debuting a selection from a new podcast called Crosswinds. Crosswinds is produced by Adrian Wood from UVA's Repair Lab. It follows the efforts of Hampton Roads residents who are demanding that the train companies manage coal dust better.
I think it would be great if y'all introduced Malcolm.
Oh, I'm doing now. Malcolm Jones is a horrible individual who is an Eagles fan, and all Eagles fans suck, okay?
I'm Lathaniel Kurtz, and I'm a practitioner in residence for the University of Virginia's Repair Lab.
A good person, a good father, and a great community member. He makes poor choices in the football team.
Okay.
My name is Malcolm Jones. I work with the UVA Repair Lab.
Everything in school, we were right next to each other. Math class, English class. That was 1993.
He was losing teeth on both sides, so when he smiled, all you saw was the two front teeth, like a little bunny rabbit. So we would always play on the playground. It was me, him, and a little boy named Andy. We would always act like we were Sonic, Knuckles, and Tails from the animated series. Neither one of us was as fast as Andy, so we always had to let him be Sonic.
Andy had asthma. He was a military brat, just like me and Malcolm were. I believe Andy was born in Hawaii, and he said the air was so much better there, but then when he moved to Virginia, it was really bad. And he said he used to be able to run all day and run on the sand and have a good time and, you know, never really get tired. But when he got here, he said he used to have asthma attacks and he used to have an inhaler. So he used to miss days from school, I remember, for his asthma, just not being there.
Malcolm and Lathaniel grew up in Norfolk, Virginia, in a predominantly black neighborhood near a coal terminal where coal is dumped from train cars onto boats. Here, coal export is a 24/7 operation that produces clouds of coal dust. Wind blows the dust into homes, cars, and gardens. People breathe it in. In Virginia in the early 90s, when Malcolm, Lathaniel, and Andy were playing Sonic, Knuckles, and Tails, mortality from asthma for black people was 200% of that for whites. 2 decades later, black people were almost 3 times as likely to die from asthma as whites. Now in 2024, the World Health Organization says air pollution is much more lethal than we once thought. Globally, air pollution is the leading environmental risk factor for disease. But this wasn't on Lathaniel's mind when he was a kid growing up in Norfolk in the 90s, when air pollution was something he could touch.
You can see a kind of a film of, you know, dirt, which I could assume now was probably coal dust. I just thought it was just dirtier at the time, but kind of thinking more about it, it was probably more coal dust at that moment.
Lathaniel and Malcolm grew up in Norfolk, one of seven cities in the Hampton Roads region of Virginia. Newport News is another Hampton Roads city, and they have the same problem in their southeast community, which is right next to another coal terminal. Here in 2011, Southeast Newport News had an emergency room rate for asthma attacks double that of the rest of the city. That survey showed almost half of residents saying the cause of their asthma was coal dust. Since then, the value of coal export in the U.S. plummeted, hit record lows around 2016, then rose again. Now, it's worth half a billion more than when that asthma study was done back in 2011. But all that profit doesn't come without a cost. The industry takes a heavy toll on people's health and well-being, as well as the environment. For a long time, it was seen as okay for Black people to bear the brunt of these costs. This disparity has a name. It's environmental racism. This series seeks to understand how coal dust pollution affects two Black communities in Hampton Roads and how those communities continue to fight against environmental racism. Whose responsibility is it to clean up the coal dust? What are residents asking for? And what must they do to prove that their problems are real and worthy of repair? Welcome to Crosswinds. I'm Adrienne Wood. I'm a white trans sound artist and producer for the Repair Lab at the University of Virginia. This show comes out of a question from Malcolm Jones and Lathaniel Kurtz. How can coal dust be reduced in Hampton Roads to achieve environmental justice?
We breathe the same air. And I think more people came to that realization in the area when there was a forest fire in Canada, and then the smoke made its way all the way down here to Virginia. People had the understanding then. The same thing is happening right now with the coal dust Norfolk Southern. The same thing is happening with the coal dust of CSX.
Lathaniel just named two rail companies, Norfolk Southern and CSX, that transport coal to the terminals in Hampton Roads. Legally, each terminal is allowed to emit up to 150 tons of coal dust into the air every year. That's the equivalent of an adult blue whale's worth of dust released into the air every year. A lot of people in Hampton Roads know that the coal dust is a problem, but that community knowledge hasn't yet led to a long-term, viable solution. What will it take for these communities to have access to clean, healthy air? It seems like common sense that respiratory health problems in these neighborhoods are related to the coal dust. Coal dust can contain mercury, lead, arsenic, cadmium, and silica. These are known to cause cancer, fetal defects, and neurological damage, even at very low doses. There is no safe level of exposure. Though the mechanics of each terminal are a little different, both of them end up dumping out freight cars full of coal, either onto boats or big piles where it gets stored. Every time a coal car is unloaded, it sends a plume of dust into the air that can be carried by wind through windows and into homes in the neighborhood. When the coal dust lands somewhere, the heavy metals it contains accumulate. They build up in soil and in water, as well as on surfaces like playgrounds, plants, and porches. None of this is new. The coal terminals date back to 1865. For a long time, they brought money and jobs to the neighborhoods that surround them, and the dust was a trade-off that came with the industry. Now that these terminals employ fewer locals, the question lingers. Who gets to decide the threshold of that trade-off when the residents are bearing the brunt of the cost? To understand this question, we have to understand who is responsible legally for regulating the coal terminals.
So what is DEQ and what do we do? DEQ, or Department of Environmental Quality, is a state agency that protects the environment and in turn...
That's Grace Holmes, Environmental Justice Coordinator with the Department of Environmental Quality, the DEQ. Grace is introducing the DEQ at a community meeting in Lamberts Point, Norfolk in 2022.
They're required to do a lot under federal programs such as the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act,
which was passed in the 70s. The DEQ makes sure industries like coal terminals are in compliance with standards set by the Clean Air Act.
Department of Environmental Quality was like established in the 90s, which is almost like 20 years later than a lot of other surrounding states would.
This is Dr. Kim Fields, an environmental policy expert at the University of Virginia and an assistant professor in African American Studies.
So it had a late start. It has meant that most of its environmental regulatory management has been not as strong. So they just don't do a good job in general of getting things cleaned up or managed properly.
In 1995, when the DEQ was just getting off the ground and Malcolm and Nathaniel were kids, the de facto definition of environmental racism was
overt, kind of intentional discrimination based on race.
If community activists couldn't prove that intentional race-based discrimination guided government behavior, then there was no requirement for the state to step in and try and fix things.
That really makes it difficult to move for remedy. For environmental justice activists, you know, it really put a damper on their ability to press for changes that would have to come from state government.
What did all of this mean for Malcolm, Nathaniel, and Andy? Well, when all the DEQ consolidations were going on in the 90s, these three kids were running around on a playground in Hampton Roads, the region of Virginia that has both the highest concentration of Black residents in the state and the biggest coal export operation in the country. So when coal dust was billowing out of the export terminal in their neighborhood, no one knew how much of it these kids were breathing in. There is a reason why the coal terminals in Hampton Roads are surrounded by Black neighborhoods. Let's look at Newport News first.
The first slaves were brought here on the White Lion.
This is Michael Mines, Pastor Mike. He's a musician and a community leader in Newport News with Flow Church and Peninsula Baptist Association. Southeast Newport News is one of the oldest African-American waterfront communities in the country. The region has a rich history of freed, enslaved, and self-emancipated Africans and African-Americans whose descendants still thrive in this historic community.
When Virginia seceded from the Union, Fort Monroe became Union-held territory.
Is that here in Newport News?
Yeah. 15 minutes from here.
Fort Monroe is where the first slave ship landed, at Point Comfort, right next to Newport News. Early on in the Civil War, Fort Monroe was seized by the Union.
And so slaves began to come to Fort Monroe seeking asylum.
Around this time, the Union made a decree that if enslaved people came to Union-held territory, they wouldn't be returned to their Confederate owners. Instead, they would become, quote-unquote, contraband, a gray area between free and unfree, but a definite improvement from being enslaved.
And so when that word got out, slaves all over the country began to run to Union-held territories. So by the time Lincoln signed the Emancipation, they were already running anyway. So it was already going downhill. He just gave it another shove. And that's a piece of lost history. And there are living contraband descendants here.
Enslaved people were already self-emancipating before this, especially around Hampton Roads, which had key locations on the Underground Railroad.
For both the the first slaves to arrive here, and then the thread to be pulled that unraveled slavery to both be on the same beach.
Newport News is on a spit of land surrounded by deep water that makes it a natural port. It's why the ships carrying enslaved people docked in this area in 1619. The deep water is also why coal was shipped out of here in the 1870s. In that era, post-Reconstruction, thousands of African Americans fled racial terror across the South. In Newport News, they found jobs exporting coal and building ships. Those industries made it one of the biggest cities in the region. Many African Americans settled in the east end of downtown Newport News, one of the first areas to be established in the growing city. East End, also known as the Southeast Community, is still right next to the coal terminal. Newport News continued to grow in a pattern that's now familiar across America. Processes like redlining and white flight codified racial segregation. As of the 2020 census, the Southeast Community is 81% African American. On the other side of the Elizabeth River, from Newport News, Lamberts Point, Norfolk, has its own history of coal export.
My name is Carl Poole. Let's see, family's from Norfolk. I see this every single day. I see it where I work at. I watch these trains go back and forth. I can see the black clouds going up.
Carl works in Lamberts Point, which is next to the coal terminal in Norfolk. Although the coal dust has always seemed like a given, Carl believes things can change. He works as an advocate with New Virginia Majority, a group focused on racial and economic justice.
I can do something, even if it's not going to work, even if nobody else thinks it's going to do anything.
Carl knows the history of Lamberts Point well from working in the neighborhood.
Lamberts Point, from its origins, is kind of a working-class neighborhood. The neighborhood grew up, built in and around Norfolk Southern's coal distribution.
Coal started getting shipped out of Lamberts Point in 1910. At that time, the neighborhood was mostly white dock workers at the coal pier.
That's how the neighborhood got there. It was originally built to house folks working for the railroad, working for Norfolk Southern. They've been moving coal in one form or another in that area for well over 100 years.
By the 1930s, the coal terminal employed more machines and fewer humans. By the time the neighborhood got redlined in 1940, many of the white former employees had already moved out. That's actually part of why it was redlined. That and the exposure to the dirty industry of coal export. In later decades, more white families left and more black families moved in, but the coal dust stayed. Even though Norfolk and Newport News have slightly different stories of how they ended up with giant coal terminals, the end effect is similar. Coal dust pollution seeps into the air, soil, and water of black neighborhoods. Even as we've raised our standards for clean air over the past few decades nationwide, the contamination continues in Norfolk.
They've been there longer than the neighborhood. There's not a lot of political will to tell Norfolk Southern what to do. Meanwhile, the neighborhood, in a lot of different ways, feels ignored, disregarded. And Norfolk Southern doesn't feel like, you know, there's a threat from the neighborhood as far as how they do business. And when it comes to air quality, how they address it, they will say, there's not a problem. We've tested things on our yard. So, you know, where's the problem?
When Carl says Norfolk Southern tested things, he's referring to tests that Norfolk Southern either did in-house or paid a third party to do. Since 1994, the state government has required Norfolk Southern to publish the results of these air quality tests in an annual report
to the Joint Subcommittee Studying Measures to Reduce Emissions from Coal-Carrying Railroad Cars.
Malcolm is reading from the 2020 report.
The Lamberts Point Community Monitoring Program monitors airborne particulates in the area surrounding the Lamberts Point coal pier.
Malcolm, Lathaniel, and I are looking at the archive of air quality reports from Norfolk Southern.
They've been monitoring privately for like 20-plus years.
So would that mean they already have the data on the impact that the coal dust is having?
I think we don't know because they don't release other data.
Since 1996, all of the information in these reports about coal dust emissions was self-reported by Norfolk Southern, the emitter.
Self-reporting yourself and writing a letter is completely the same to me as me reporting myself for a speeding ticket every year. I'm going to always go with the under. And I'm never going to say, hey, I was recklessly driving. It's never going to happen.
And then you're strategically showing that the number is going down. But are you really changing anything? Did you actually do any interventions to impact it? But there's no graphs. There's nothing showing us averages over the last 5 years, over the last 10 years. There's nothing showing us the baselines of where you originally started with your reports to now. So how are the numbers going down without any interventions?
The reports show what Norfolk Southern needs them to show, which is that they are following the rules and reporting air particulates that come when they dump billions of dollars of coal from rail cars onto barges. For a while, they even had a hotline for residents to call and report coal dust issues. It's 1-800-DUSTING, dusting. But almost no one ever called it because almost nobody knew about it. It's just another way that coal terminals in Hampton Roads follow rules that are set up for their own benefit. In a regulatory picture with profit in the front and people shoved in the back, the filthy porches and asthma inhalers and communities of color get cropped out. The way that environmental racism is defined in Virginia makes it hard for advocates like Malcolm or Lathaniel or Carl to push the government for help. Legally, to prove that it's environmental racism, they'd have to have records showing the coal terminals explicitly acknowledging decisions to pollute these neighborhoods because they are Black neighborhoods. And those records don't exist right now. But the pollution is visible. It's tangible, and it has been for a long time. It's clear how personal this fight is to Malcolm and Lathaniel. They grew up watching their friends struggle to breathe. Andy was no longer the neighborhood sonic. Malcolm's younger sister wheezed when she went outside. When they drove me around Lambert's Point, the neighborhood near where they grew up in Norfolk, I saw how the problem was so close to home.
I'll sit in the back.
Oh, you're good.
I want to sit in the car seat.
I want to get the front. It's bad.
Okay. It can't be that bad.
Like the field where they played high school football games.
That's our home field. Me and Michael actually used to play football for Maury High.
Their home field still sits right next to Norfolk Southern's coal export terminal in Lambert's Point. If you look at the field from a bird's eye view, one corner is actually cut off by the train tracks. That's how close the football players are to trains that cart thousands of tons of coal to the port, leaving plumes of coal dust along the way. Though they grew up watching loved ones suffer from the health effects of coal dust, Malcolm and Lathaniel weren't necessarily aware of the cause. When they were kids, the dust was just there, like the highway or the train tracks. As adults facing environmental racism, their attitude is still intrepid. Even though environmental racism can feel so entrenched through complicated regulations and confusing state agencies with mismatched priorities, these two are willing to take things one step at a time to move towards their goal of healthy lives for the people in their community. Malcolm and Lathaniel started looking at the coal dust problem because it spoke to them as a problem that affects everything else, a kind of baseline that they wanted to raise to improve outcomes in other areas like physical and mental health.
The same thing that was going on in Norfolk was going on in my own backyard in Newport News. And so at that point, I was like, hey, I have to be more involved. I can't do it all by myself because I'm one man, and the one person I could think about that could help me and assist me was you, Malcolm.
I don't think I would trust anyone else with this project. Knowing him, I know his values, I know his ethics, I know his standards. I know how hard he wants to fight for people to have the same things that he has.
Part of the mission is to bring awareness to the issue that's going on in our community and to come up with some type of proposal for legislation and public policy.
And that's why we're here. As practitioners and residents at the Repair Lab, Malcolm and Nathaniel are bringing attention to the coal dust problem and attempting to intervene. Over the next few episodes, this podcast will explore the origins of the coal dust problem and ask what environmental justice should look like. Coal dust has been negatively affecting families in Hampton Roads for generations.
You look at the East End side of Newport News and Lambert's Point. Capitalism at the expense of Black and brown people continues to be a trend.
It's all about extracting wealth, extracting labor, extracting humanity, and building wealth for private entities.
How did this happen? What did people experience as the tracks for present-day environmental racism were laid? In the next episode, we'll trace a journey following the coal back into the mountains of West Virginia and back in time to before the railroads got built.
Crosswinds is a podcast written, reported, produced, edited, hosted, mixed, and mastered by Adrian Wood. Editing is by Oluwakimi Oladesui of Rough Cut Collective. Scoring by Torin Puckett and Adrian Wood. The Repair Lab is funded by the Karsh Institute of Democracy at the University of Virginia. Transcripts for this and all episodes can be found at coaldustkills.org. Follow the Repair Lab on X at the Repair Lab or Instagram at Coal Dust Kills. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Aviva Costo and Andrew Rice are our interns. Special thanks to Jenny Taylor for booking assistance. For the With Good Reason podcast or to comment, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening. Welcome back to With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. People who live near the coal terminals in Hampton Roads, Virginia, want to breathe better air. For generations, Norfolk Southern and CSX Railroads, the two largest coal carriers in the country, have transported coal from the coal mines to the ports where the coal is destined for overseas. And dumping out the coal cars causes plumes of black sooty coal dust to fly into the air. Legally, they're allowed to emit the equivalent of one blue whale of coal dust into the air every year, and they do at least that. Kim Fields is the co-director of the University of Virginia's Repair Lab. She's been working with community members to get Norfolk Southern and CSX to better manage their coal dust. Kim, you've been working with residents who live near gigantic coal terminals in Norfolk and Newport News, Virginia, to try to help them reduce the toxic coal dust that's been blanketing the region for really more than 100 years. What sorts of things might help them with the coal dust, and what are you looking at as remedies?
Some of the things that might help them with the coal dust are just simple kinds of barriers like wind fences or having covers over top of the coal cars. So those are the kinds of remedies that we've been looking into.
Right now, in those areas, what is causing so much coal dust? Where does the coal dust get released in the process?
Yeah, so the coal dust is coming in on trains. They travel through the terminal, and they also sit there in the terminals and get transferred from like one car to another car or a barge or some other mode of transportation. And in the process of just traveling along the tracks or getting loaded and unloaded, it just makes its way into the air through wind.
Are those train cars filled with coal covered?
They are not covered. They have, they're supposed to have a kind of like liquid suppressant on them, like water, some kind of solution, but that is not 100% effective.
And so what's the idea? I mean, what are you seeking? Do you want to have them cover those train cars or close the system where they're dumping the coal from the cars into big piles or what?
We want the best available technology for keeping the coal out of the community. And so that could be car covers and wind fences.
What is a wind fence? How tall is it? And could that really stop the coal dust from billowing in high into the air and over into the community?
Wind fences, they are kind of like what they sound like. They're mesh kind of barriers that are erected around the perimeter of the terminals. And they are effective. They reduce the escape of particles into the community significantly. So they have wind fences like this in a lot of places.
How tall are they?
They vary in height, but they're pretty tall, many feet tall, but there's no specific height.
So you and your team of people at the University of Virginia who work at the repair lab there have been trying to get the train companies, CSX and Norfolk Southern, to erect these wind fences, and you're hoping to do it with a local ordinance? Tell me about the people you're working with locally.
So we're working with two practitioners, Nathaniel Kurtz, who is a pastor in Newport News, and Malcolm Jones, who is a community activist and educator who works in Lambert's Point.
Help me understand the repair lab, where you and a team of experts and people in affected communities and activists are doing this kind of work.
The repair lab is that. It's a team of people with different kinds of specialties and expertise working together to support the development of policy solutions around environmental justice issues. So we have scientists, policy experts, multimedia professionals, and political analysts working to support people from the communities who want to see like a very specific change happen to improve the quality of the environment and the communities that they come from. So we do whatever they need us to do. We research, we coordinate, just whatever would support that work. That's what we do.
Tell me about what's happening with the ordinance. You know, tell me about the Newport News City Council and when they'll vote on this and what their response has been to the proposed ordinance.
Well, we don't know when they're going to vote on it. We're still in conversation with people about what the community's priorities are and how they are folded into the ordinance. So it'll kind of be up to City Council to decide when, you know, they're going to or if they're going to introduce the proposal. We are hoping that in their summer session or early fall session, they introduce and then vote on the ordinance. But we're, you know, not in control of that part of the process. They have not been hostile or anything like that. We've had conversations. They show interest. So we haven't encountered any kind of like open resistance.
And there have been these fences elsewhere that have been pretty effective against coal dust, you think?
Yeah, there have been. They are considered one of the industry's best available kind of technologies for keeping particles and dust out of nearby communities.
What's an argument or a fear that somebody might have about this ordinance on the other side?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I typically boil it down to there would be just competing interests. The arguments that we have heard for not doing more than what is already done is that it would be prohibitive in costs for the companies to cover the cars or erect fences. So that's one argument. Then another argument is that there is not solid scientific evidence that the coal dust is causing physical harm. That's not the argument we're making, and that's not what the community, that's not the only thing the community is saying about why they want the cars covered or a wind fence erected. But those are the two kind of primary arguments that we've encountered.
When you say it would be costly for the companies, would that be CSX and Norfolk Southern train companies?
Yes.
Would they be the ones under this possible ordinance, which has not been proposed yet, would they be the ones who would have to bear the cost of erecting the dust-reducing fences?
That's the way we've been approaching. That's who the community thinks should be responsible.
Why not try to achieve this same thing through the EPA?
It is not a either-or type thing. There are other efforts being pursued at those levels. It is also more difficult to get responses around local issues at the national levels.
You've been working on a book about how the state responds to issues of pollution and environmental justice. What about at the state level, let's say, in Virginia? Is that a fruitful tactic?
Not right now. Under different kind of conditions, it could be more fruitful. The composition of state politics right now means that there are places in the decision-making process where these kinds of issues would run into some resistance that could keep them from getting adopted and implemented.
Are there other state tools like the Department of Environmental Quality or the Division of Natural Resources? Are those areas that might be pursued to help sort of put a damper on the coal dust?
You would think that that would be a place to go. And it kind of is, but the issue there is that the DEQ is a weaker kind of like institutional body. It has a broad mandate and a lot of responsibilities, but has not and does not always have the appropriate or adequate resources to do everything under its mandates.
Do you think people across the state care about this issue? Or only those who live near the coal dust, near the coal terminals?
We, in our research and work, have reached out to people all over Virginia, all over the country, and there is interest beyond Newport News and Lambert's Point in doing something about coal dust. Even, you know, beyond covering coal, there is interest in banning it in Virginia and beyond.
What has surprised you most as you've worked on this?
I don't know if I would use the word surprised, but because I've been researching and thinking about this stuff for a long time. But what has encouraged me is the steadfastness of people in the community's activism and commitment to doing something about this issue and other issues that impact their quality of life. They have kept the issue alive and on the political agenda for decades.
When it comes to the proposed ordinance for coal dust fencing in the Hampton Roads area, how hopeful are you?
Again, I don't know that hopeful is the word that I would use. I think that we have done what needed to be done to push the issue further down the policymaking process. So it's no longer just out there as an issue that people have talked about. It's been formalized in a way that can be presented to city council members to do something about. So beyond that, it's kind of out of our hands. So I've studied politics long enough to know that you can't always predict what's going to happen, but you can't do anything if the issue isn't formalized and put in front of people to do something about.
Well, Kim Fields, thank you for sharing your insights with me on With Good Reason.
Thank you for the opportunity. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Kim Fields is the co-director of the University of Virginia's Repair Lab. Knowledge moves slowly, and sometimes the knowledge gap between the best practices of the day and what's best for public health is too little too late. Mike Schell is a professor of biology at the University of Virginia College at Wise. He says while some companies have knowingly gone against public health guidelines, sometimes the guideline itself is harmful, and we just don't know it yet. Mike, you study the way that human cells respond to what you call environmental insults. What kinds of environmental insults?
Yeah, absolutely. When we talk about an environmental insult, we're going to be talking about some type of agent that is in our natural environment that can have an impact on us.
You know, there's been so much written recently, especially about microplastics and forever chemicals in our drinking water. Have you felt alarmed by the rise of these chemicals and plastics?
You know, we are becoming much more acutely aware of the presence of different, particularly man-made agents in our environment. And importantly, we're becoming more aware of how they can impact not just us, but all living systems inside of the biosphere, and starting to learn more about how we can either A, reduce the amount of these materials that are finding their way into our environment, or B, once they're there, identify how we can mitigate exposure and then, if necessary, treat disease states that might arise from exposure.
How do you think diseases that arise from chemicals and toxins differ from diseases that form more naturally within our bodies?
You know, that's a great question. In reality, there's not a tremendous amount of difference in terms of the disease state, regardless of which route that we see it develop.
So I wonder how scientists can tell that a disease or harm to our bodies is taking off as a result of an environmental toxin.
In a lot of ways, what we're looking at are patterns, and particularly when it comes to cancer, and I describe it to my students, that cancer is really a disease of probabilities. We're made up of trillions of cells, and they all have to be organized and working together to give rise to what we consider a human. In order to maintain that organization, we very tightly regulate when the cells can make copies of themselves. When we look at the development of cancer, what we're really seeing are cells that have somehow escaped that regular control that we use to suppress cellular reproduction. And so that's the reason why when we see cancers developing either earlier in life as a consequence, say, of an inherited state, or in higher prevalence as a consequence of exposure to a particular carcinogenic agent, what we're seeing is that we're tipping the scales in favor of generating those changes, but the process itself stays very similar in a lot of ways.
And something that you're keenly focused on in your own work is, what can we do? What is possible as far as tweaking our system so that our DNA can repair damage better than it does now?
Absolutely. And, you know, when we think about things that we can do in our day-to-day lives to help promote our own personal health, chief among those is reduction of exposure to potentially damaging agents. It's not realistic that we can completely prevent exposure to these types of agents. But rather, if we minimize our exposure and we minimize the concentration of these agents in our environment, we can minimize the chances for cellular damage, and it allows the naturally occurring processes of repair inside of our tissues an opportunity to really excel at what they do and maintain our overall homeostasis.
Give me some examples of towns that are now trying to repair the damage done from industrial pollutants to their residents.
You know, there's a number of different locations throughout the United States that fall into, say, the Superfund category, where there have been industries present that have subsequently moved on or closed, but left behind industrial contamination that is now being remediated. In our own region in Southwest Virginia, even though surface mining is not nearly as common as it was, say, about 50 or 60 years ago, we still see the effects of pre-reclamation mine drainage throughout our region. Mine drainage is one of those things that can impact our overall environment in a lot of different ways.
Does it get into the drinking water?
It can, just through runoff processes. And so some of the things that we do now in order to help minimize that, first off, is that if mining exercises are disturbing the natural landscape, mine agencies are required to, within reason, restore the original features of the land in order to help control both the potential for exposure to materials that have been uncovered as part of the mining process, as well as to help control things like mine runoff that have the potential to spread the contamination further throughout the region.
There's a powerful book called Tom's River about industrial pollutants, toxic chemicals that were deliberately released into the nearby river of a town where many people, and especially children, developed cancer and died.
There are examples in history of environmental contaminations that have occurred either through directed release of materials, even in opposition to the standard safety protocols of the time. But at the same point, we've seen many instances of environmental contamination and exposure that have occurred in line with the accepted safety practices of the time. And as we've learned more, we've changed the practices.
What are some examples of that?
So there was a small town, and I'm wanting to believe it was in Missouri back in the late 70s, early 80s, that was contaminated with dioxin, which is a very powerful environmental toxin and has significant health ramifications on humans. During that time, many of the roads in the area were unpaved and during hot, dry summers would become dusty. And in order to maintain the town's roads and to cut down on dust contamination, and the practice at the time was to spray the roads with oil-containing solutions. So the oils would act as binding agents to bring the clay back together and cut down on dust contamination. And so this was a standard protocol that was employed at the time, particularly in rural areas. And the town contracted with an individual who purchased petroleum byproducts from a local industry, leading to a widespread contamination, ultimately leading to the town being abandoned by the population. The federal government came in and relocated many of the residents and then led an extensive decontamination of the region.
It's so hard to get good information. Like you're saying, the town sort of innocently embarked on what they thought was a good practice that turned out to be damaging. We often hear these stories about how residents suffer health consequences, But the burden of proof seems to land on people who don't really feel equipped to understand the science behind it. You know, unless you have really great activists and scientific minds, it's hard to do anything or even know that you've been harmed.
That is an unfortunate consequence of our learning process in terms of environmental contamination and public health. When asked about how communities can learn more about the processes that are occurring in their areas and how they impact the population, we're seeing increasingly that citizen science initiatives, where we see general population individuals who are concerned about their communities, working alongside of science and health officials, are able to make positive impacts in their communities. And so while the problem might seem at first blush insurmountable, particularly if you're living in that community, we do encourage people to take the opportunity to engage with professionals in their regions.
Mike Schell is a professor of biology at the University of Virginia College at Wise. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Aviva Costo and Andrew Rice are interns. Special thanks to Jenny Taylor for booking assistance. For the podcast or comment, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.